Welcome to Alpha Trader. Coming up on the show, Jack Barugian, Chief Economist, Co-Founder and Director of the Universal Compute Exchange and Chairman of the Global Smart Commodity Group. But first, Stephen and I coming to you at the start of a week where the rally appears set to continue after obviously an incredible performance in April and May and the first week of June. The S&P 500 on the cusp of wiping out its losses for 2020. The NASDAQ intraday last week hit an all-time high. Incredible stuff. Since the S&P 500 bottomed on March 23rd, the index has gained over 40% and notched its best 50-day rally ever recorded. It's just incredible what we've seen here. And Stephen, we were talking last week with our colleague Nathaniel Baker, who sort of quipped that we've gone from FOMO, fear of missing out, to POMO, panic of missing out.
Right, correct.
What are you seeing out there?
Certainly, Nathaniel did a great job with that. I think he's right on the money. We're speaking on Monday morning. Stan Druckenmiller was on CNBC a few minutes ago. And if everyone remembers, about a month ago, he said the risk reward in this market is the worst he's ever seen. And he's on CNBC this morning saying the market has humbled him yet again. The market rallied right through kind of his bearish attitude. The S&P 500 is up 11% since he spoke. It's not even been a month. He said he failed on two points. One was how far the Fed would go to backstop things and to buy up assets. And two, he failed to anticipate kind of the general excitement about the reopening of the economy.
Right. He said, quote, "I've been far too cautious. I missed a great opportunity here," end quote. And I just want to stop for a second and say, look, there are a lot of us who are feeling that way. So you're in very good company. Stan Druckenmiller is one of the most successful investors of the last 50 years. And you know, around the same time he was making his initial comments, he had Sam Zell saying similar things, Warren Buffett by extension, you know, that he was a seller back in March. Bill Ackman was on CNBC saying, you know, hell is coming. So, you know, it's okay to be wrong. And some of the best investors of all time get it wrong, certainly. And, you know, how do you manage those losses? How do you then say, am I going to continue to fight this tape or do I want to rethink my macro outlook or what's really happening here? So again, we're not saying this to make fun of Stan Druckenmiller, and good for him for coming out and saying, you know, I was too cautious and I made a mistake. And as you referenced, he said he's been humbled many times in his career. And it's been an incredible career that any of us would kill for in terms right. of his success on Wall Street.
Remember another great investor, Michael Steinhardt, said, hey, you know, I might get things right 51% of the time, but when I'm wrong, I see why I'm wrong and I have no problem changing my mind. That's their great talent. Not that they're right, you know, 100% of the time or even 70% of the time. Maybe just a hair more than they're wrong and they get out when they're wrong.
That's right. And Stan Druckenmiller himself is you know, widely noted as one of those people who's really great at managing risks. And if he gets a trade wrong, he'll reverse it. You know, again, you're in good company if you've been too cautious these last 9-10 weeks, for sure. So again, here we are. We're talking Monday morning. Markets are poised to head higher. Over the weekend, the OPEC Plus group agreeing to extend its record production cuts. That had West Texas Intermediate above $40 a barrel intraday this morning for the first time since early March. It's since pulled back, but you're seeing huge moves pre-market, at least Monday, in Marathon and Occidental and other energy players. And again, it's incredible to think back that, you know, oil went negative at one point. And, you know, that was an anomaly in the futures market. But like how dramatically things collapsed, and how dramatically they've come back, how rapidly they've come back.
Yeah, and that was the exact bottom, was that bizarre negative print. Other oil news today, British Petroleum, BP, announced 10,000 job cuts, most of which are going to take place this year. And 10,000 is, that's against a global workforce of about 70,000. So it's huge job cuts that they're announcing. And that stock's ahead about 3% pre-market.
Right. So not to be flip, right? It's, you know, the more job cuts equals better stock performance. That's an unfortunate occurrence we see too often. And we do get into this more with Jack Barugian coming up in the second part of the show today. But, you know, of course, the market's still, I think, feeling a sense of optimism after Friday's much better. I mean, much better than expected is a huge understatement of how strong the jobs report was on Friday compared to what the expectations were. And yet we still have an unemployment rate of 13%+. And we still had 40 million plus people file for jobless claims in the last 2 months. So, you know, we cannot dismiss the pain that's happening in the real economy here. And of course, the question is the real economy going to catch up to the stock market, or is the stock market going to come back down to reality of what's happening on Main Street?
Yeah. Another kind of shop buying the news on Friday is Morgan Stanley. They were out with a note over the weekend that they're adding to bets on yield curve steepeners. So they expect the 10-year, 30-year rates to continue to rise. They rose big last week while the Fed sits on a 0% Fed funds rate, you know, maybe for the rest of our lifetimes. So they're buying kind of the news that the economy is bouncing rather quickly.
Right. And you know, we're at this point in the cycle where rising rates are a good thing because it's a sign of people feeling like, okay, we're not going into a deflationary spiral. We're not going to be Japan. You know, again, it was a couple of months ago, the yield curve inverted and people said, oh, there's a recession in the offing. And I don't think that was about the COVID panic. I think that was more, you know, a macroeconomic concern. And maybe we will see that recession somewhere in the next year to 18 months. But right now, rising yields and a steepening yield curve has definitely been good for financials, because that's how they make the big bucks. And it is giving people some confidence that maybe the stock market has it right. Maybe the economy is going to come back in a V shape. I mean, again, you know, it's hard for, certainly if you've lost your job, it's hard for people who are struggling right now to foresee that, but that's what the markets are hopefully pointing to. The other thing I will note that Morgan Stanley separately saying is that it's, quote, it's time to move on to the next chapter of the playbook, which means rotating even more cyclically. Near-term cyclicals may be a bit extended, but we think the primary trend is higher and we are looking to add exposure, particularly on dips. And this coming after a week in which value stocks outperformed growth by the most since 2009. And that was only the third time since 1995 that the S&P climbed more than 4% in a week, and when value outperformed by at least 4.5%, which is how much it outperformed last week. Yeah. So, and you know, the two times it did that was May 2009 and March 2000. Now, if memory serves, those weren't particularly good times to be in the market. So, you know, a little bit of note of caution there. But the larger point is that we are seeing a widening of the breadth of the market. Right. For a while, it was just all about the big cap technology stocks, and the mega cap tech stocks were pushing the indices much higher. And people were saying that that isn't sustainable, and it probably isn't. And we are seeing a broadening out of the market in the last few weeks, which is a healthy sign, a good sign.
We're at that stage where that's that sort of thing is a really good sign, where rising yields are a really good sign. It's a pretty sweet spot to be in. At some point, rising yields become, it goes from, hey, this is a great sign, we're not going into a inverted yield curve or another recession, economic activity comes back. And then at some point it hits a level, I don't know what it's going to be in the 10-year, 1%, 1.5%, 2%, where people said, oh my gosh, rising yields are going to clamp down economic activity. And now we have to worry about higher short-term rates and possible recession down the road.
Yeah, I guess it's Goldilocks at the moment.
Oh my goodness.
And of course, you know, if rates start to rise too much, you know, people will turn their eyes to the Fed, which does meet this week. And Jay Powell has a press conference on Wednesday. There's, of course, no expectation at all that they're going to change rates at this meeting. But there is some speculation that they could target long-term treasury yields, which is something other global central bankers have done as sort of, you know, the next policy announcement that they might go after to sort of say that, you know, we're gonna aim to keep rates at X level or get them up to X level. So that's the thing I think a lot of Fed watchers are looking for from the Fed meeting this week. But and of course, you know, in a press conference, you never know what Jay Powell will say that might move markets one way or the other. What's really interesting is what's happened in the corporate debt market, where this is according to Bloomberg, borrowing costs have gone back to near all-time lows for investment grade debt. Companies have sold about $1 trillion of bonds. And that's after the Fed announced their plan to pump liquidity into the corporate debt markets, but they haven't done it yet. It hasn't even started yet. So this is something we've talked about with Mark Dow and Cullen Roche and other guests, that just the Fed saying, hey, we're going to do something is enough to move the needle. They haven't actually had to spend the money yet, at least not in the corporate debt market.
Right. Oh, they did buy some ETFs, but it's a
like $3 billion. I mean, like
right. It
sounds like a lot to you and me, but you know.
Right. It's not even like dropping a pebble in the ocean. I mean, it's tiny compared to the size of the market. But yeah, what does Mark call it? He calls it the placebo effect.
Right.
All they have to do is kind of talk about it, and it's investor risk appetite that really kind of drives where markets are going to go.
Yeah, man, we are in a risk on moment, at least as we're speaking here Monday morning, shortly before the open. One thing I wanted to ask you about, there was a Bloomberg report out this morning about AstraZeneca approaching Gilead Sciences about a potential mega merger. And Gilead's the only company to have received FDA authorization for its COVID-19 treatment for remdesivir, which we've talked about here with Adam Feuerstein on the show. That would be a you know, deal making always gets the juices flowing on Wall Street. That would be a big one. Do you have any more information on that particular deal at this point?
No, but it is a sizable one. It would be about $100 billion takeover, I believe, at current prices. And Gilead's up a little bit pre-market. Both kind of the chatter I'm hearing is that Gilead really wasn't interested. AstraZeneca has its own COVID-19 treatment that it's working on. So it would be kind of a teaming up of two pretty big players who are working on major treatments. As far as what I'm hearing this morning, was little progress was made. There's no formal talks. It was an approach, and somebody kind of leaked the approach, and that's where we are now.
Interesting. Okay. Well, obviously something, you know, people keep an eye on that for sure. And other deal making, of course, you know, we haven't seen much in the way of M&A, understandably, since the crisis started. We did see a revival of the IPO market last week. Vroom, which I believe you're a fan and a user of, online car shopping.
Sure.
Went public. There was another Zoom company. I'm now blanking on the name. But Zoom, you know, I think it was Zoom Info. Thank you. Yes, I think it was $8+ billion of IPOs were launched last week, and you know, the first deal since the pandemic hit. So you know, again, IPOs, you know, great for Wall Street for the investment banking fees and gets people's juices flowing when these deals do well, and they have done well coming out of the gates.
Yeah, Zoom Info, I believe, was up, I don't, whatever, 15-20% off its IPO price. I couldn't tell you what they do. I know they have a perfect name for the times, though.
They absolutely do. Yes. All right. And anything else you're keeping an eye at that's going to be on your radar for the coming week?
We're pretty much done with Q1 earnings season. There might be a few straggler retailers still to report. So earnings is kind of down. I guess we'll pay attention to presentations. Normally there would be a lot of conferences this month, but they'll be virtual. So we'll keep a look at those and see what managements have to say about how Q2 is going.
Right. And then the other thing is, and I meant to mention this, we were talking about COVID-19 earlier, and you know, that there is a rise in cases in certain parts of the country after they loosened things up around Memorial Day. There's concerns we're going to see another wave after all the protests we've seen in cities across the country the last couple of weeks. And yet, as this week, New York City's starting their phase 1 reopening with some construction and manufacturing, some retailers going to be reopening in the subway system, one of the world's largest, if not the largest, reopening as well. So, you know, obviously, a lot to watch on the reopening phase. You know, the stock market is saying the reopening is coming and it's going to be positive, and let's hope the reality meets that.
Yeah, I'm here in Montgomery County, just outside of Philadelphia, and I noticed outdoor dining was available. I drove by a few places yesterday evening where folks were sitting outside and being served by waiters and having drinks and dinner. So it was a nice thing to see. But yeah, this is the one thing I think that would put an immediate stop to the bull market, is if cases start to rise, hospitalizations start to rise again. You know, we're in for a very bad run in stocks. We kind of sat here in February and the market kind of poo-pooed what was going on around the world until like just one day it didn't anymore. And that was kind of the end of the bull market right there.
Yeah, that's a great point. I think it was the numbers from Italy over the weekend in February. They saw a big spike in Italy. And right now you're seeing big spikes in Brazil and India, some other emerging economies. So obviously we are by no means out of the woods in terms of this pandemic. And again, let's hope that the stock market has it right, not just for investors, but you know, for all of our health and sanity, really, that the worst has passed with this pandemic.
Sure.
All right. Coming up on the show, Jack Baroogian, chief economist and co-founder and director of the Universal Compute Exchange and chairman of the Global Smart Commodity Group. We'll be right back with more Alpha Trader. Welcome to Alpha Trader. We're joined by Jack Baroogian, chief economist, co-founder and director of the Universal Compute Exchange. He is also chairman of the Global Smart Commodity Group. Jack, welcome to Alpha Trader.
No, thank you.
So thanks for being here. So we're a weekly podcast. So, you know, we try to step back a little bit from the daily noise. And as I think back, I feel like I've been a broken record the last several weeks talking about how the market keeps shaking off all this horrible news, you know, obviously of the COVID-19 pandemic and the related shutdowns, 40 million plus people filing for jobless claims, U.S.-China tensions ratcheting up. And then in this last week or so, mass protests and some rioting across America in the wake of the killing of George Floyd. So from your point of view, Jack, how do you explain the fact that amid all that, we just went through the largest 50-day rally in the S&P 500 since it moved to 500 stocks in 1957? So the biggest 50-day rally ever.
Aaron, that's a question that's probably asked, you know, by more portfolio managers and more people running money than I have ever heard before. And I guess the one thing to say is that when markets act the way they just did, where you see that severe plunge and a rally back, it usually signals that they never belonged at that level. They were mispriced to begin with. Now, having said that, any rational person would look at the universe the way it is right now and think to themselves, there's no way the market could be where it's at. But we continue to forget one thing. We have got a Federal Reserve that is doing more now than they did back in the Great Recession. They have literally told us that they are going to be dumping dollars out of helicopters. We're seeing the same thing happen out in Europe. And all of that is really acting as a safety net. And more importantly, there's some optimism that's brewing in this reopening. And, you know, one of the things that I've noticed, especially throughout this entire process of the lockdown, is that people are convinced that there is light at the end of the tunnel. This is not something that is going to be a permanent lifestyle change. Now, you know, we could all be 100% wrong, you know, with that synopsis. So the real question is, you know, how all of that will play out within the next few months. And is the market mispriced now on this bounce?
Right. Well, that was my next question. So I could see the thinking that the market was mispriced at the lows of late March. You know, people got oversold and people got a little too panicky. Are we priced correctly now? You know, because of course people talking about how high PEs are and the market's overvalued by most historic measures, you know, no matter how you look at it, CAPE, well, ratio, PE, whatever it is.
It's almost hard to draw a PE in the market. I mean, if somebody were to tell me that the S&P is trading 20 times over earnings, I'd say to them, well, how do you know what earnings are? Right. You know, and how do you estimate them for these next couple of, so, you know, I guess the real question is, and this is the question that every trader and investor should ask themselves, is are we going to see more carnage from what just happened? Or is the carnage behind us? And what I mean by that is, are we going to see a flood of bankruptcies, mortgage delinquencies, people that were laid off that are not rehired because companies now realize they can do a lot more with less? You know, this is the thing. And you know, let's understand that you know, corporations do not have a conscience in many cases, nor does a balance sheet. And when you realize that you can be just as productive, you know, with 50 people than you were with, you know, as you were with 75 people, well, guess what happens to that 25 people, those 25 heads? They are now dispensable. And, you know, whether it happens now or whether it happens later, this is going to be a consequence of what we just went through. And many of us, you know, saw it coming. The real question was whether it was going to happen in 3 or 5 years or not. And now that has been brought and been sped up. It's now happening within this 1 to 2 year time frame.
I'm sorry, what do you mean what's been sped up? The work from home process?
If you think about it, companies and corporations have been forced to become more efficient. And that, because of the work from home aspect of it all, and I could take that just from personal experiences, I've seen that with the various companies and startups that I have, people are basically more productive at home. And I found that to be an absolutely fascinating aspect of what just happened here. We're learning how to do everything from home now. I mean, you know, used to be where I do, you know, all my shopping from home. And then eventually I started doing, you know, all my banking from home. Well, you know, and now I'm doing all my working from home, and it's starting to become very natural. And what that's going to do, and I think a lot of that is being factored into the pricing of where we see the equities right now, because there is a level of efficiency brought on by technology that is being layered in, and people saw it. They saw it from the outside, but now they're actually feeling it and they're experiencing it on the inside.
Yes, and I spent part of last week reading a lot of earnings calls, transcripts, and listening to some company presentations as presentation season kind of began after earnings season ended. And you hear that a lot, that what was going to take 3 to 5 years has been compressed to basically the last 3 months, whether it be work from home, shop from home, and any number of things. I heard that said quite a bit, and it makes sense to me. were speaking on a Friday morning, and a few minutes ago, we had the jobs report, and economists were off by about 10 million. You were expecting an 8 million job loss in May. And
just a margin of error, margin of error. Yeah.
And we ended up adding 2.5 million jobs in May. So it's quite the talk. And I was wondering what your thoughts were on that.
I guess the first thing I'll say is that I was one of those people that was wrong on that number, although I didn't look for that big of a drop. In fact, I had this argument with my good friend, Rick Santelli. I see him every now and then. And Rick goes, "We're going to see a big surprise to the upside." And I said, "Well, why do you say that?" And he said, "Because that first number back is always the big bounce back in jobs." And you know what? That made sense to me. So today's number to me is not a shock. I think it would be a shock if we continued to see numbers like this. Then everybody that is sitting on the sidelines in cash is caught offsides. They are completely misreading the marketplace. And, you know, for those of us that have been taught to be able to average in and buy dips whenever they happen, you know, you look back on this last, you know, 6-7 weeks and you think to yourself, well, you know, thank goodness I followed certain disciplines. You know, even though I had to hold my nose at the time and buy certain things, I knew that it was the right move because down the road, eventually I'd be happy, but I didn't think it was going to be instant gratification. So I guess having said that though, you know, I think all of that is also being found in these jobs numbers. What I would like to see though is a couple of months in a row where we see this type of action. And I'm very concerned that over the course of the summer, we're not going to see that type of good optimistic number come out of the Labor Department.
Yeah, right. There's the argument that some of the surprising strength in the jobs numbers is because of the PPP loans and basically companies, you know, had the funds in order to not lay people off. Did you have a chance to dig into the data and see how much of a factor that might have been?
I think that was a big factor. I looked into some of that data. The real question, I think that's why we need at least 2 or 3 months worth of this data to really understand the full effects of PPP and how it's playing out. See, I guess, and the other part is the savings rate. I mean, if you remember last week, we saw a savings rate that jumped astronomically.
Right.
It was up by 25% or something. And then, I mean, that's something that is not going to continue. If it does, it's detrimental to the economy down the road. You know, it turns us into Japan, and that's not what we want to see. But I guess one thing that I will point out in this jobs number is the fact that a lot of the jobs that are coming back were temporary furloughs. And I'm worried, again, that some of the jobs that have been eliminated or were, you know, are not going to come back. And it's not because people are getting more money than they, you know, on unemployment than they were, which is happening in some cases. But I, again, from what I said earlier, you're finding that there's just more efficiency out there, that you can do more with less. And if that's the case, there's going to be a significant part of the workforce that has trouble coming back, in which case that we're not going to see those unemployment numbers that we saw in January and February, not at least not for quite a while. And I've got a feeling that in itself might be a drag on the markets, especially going into the election.
All right. So turning it back to the market, as you mentioned before, you know, about cheat and corporations, they don't have conscience, neither does the stock market. Right. So whether you have agreed with it or not, the market is where it is. How are you positioned here now? Do you expect to see this rally continue? I mean, we're now pushing 3,200 on the S&P 500. Probably, you know, we're not that far off from the all-time highs, just below 3,400. Do you think we'll get back there anytime soon?
I am, let's put it this way, reluctantly long with a small L, and I am a bull. And that tells you that I'm a nervous long. And a very nervous long at that, only because I'm concerned about what earnings are going to be like over the course of these next couple of quarters. I don't know how bad the carnage is. If there's ever a time, you know, to hedge in May and walk away, this is probably it. You know, there's always that ad, you know, I've always heard people say, oh, you sell in May and walk away. And I always just say, oh, come on, that's ridiculous. But you know what I do think is this is the year that you hedge in May and you walk away, even though this is going to be a very critical time for equity markets, not only here, but around the world, because you're dealing with central banks that are flooding the system with liquidity. And the real question is when they start to pull back on that liquidity, you know, how hard will it be to get off that drug? What are going to be the withdrawal systems once we start to, you know, reduce those steroid injections and eventually wean the patient off steroids? And that's really where we've got to start focusing. And I would hope, you know, the the market will start focusing on that. And look, and again, that's why I'm reluctantly long, because I might be 100% wrong. And this thing can continue to see this parabolic move over the course of the next 6 months. You know, the market can stay wrong a lot longer than I can think I'm right, you know, right. And I will, you know, but and discipline kind of dictates that. But there is a disconnect out there. Let's not kid ourselves. There's a big disconnect right now taking place between what's out there in the economy and what is happening on Wall Street. And that disconnect cannot continue. It's more of the slingshot after that big move down. So either the economy is going to get quite a bit better over the course of the next few months, or the stock market will get hit over the next few months. And it's as simple as that, I think.
Yeah. So can you talk about the mechanics of your hedging, or how you would approach it as a listener, what you would recommend they do?
If you're an option trader, then there's nothing like putting on a downside spreads, one by twos. I call them the slingshot. You sell one, you buy two puts. So what you do is you give yourself that slingshot approach where you lock yourself in on a spread that you might sell, and it pays for the other put. The other thing that I really think is a good thing to do is to look at futures. If you use futures and options, and again, not everybody is qualified to do that. So I would say make sure that you know what you're doing. But it's a good way to be able to go in there and be able to hedge out certain amounts of exposure, especially if you're indexed. A lot of people right now are using indexation. They've got the spiders on, they've got Qs on. Well, one of the best ways to do that is to actually take the real product that's out there on the futures side and be able to trade against it. You know, I used to tell people that I'd always want to be short in the futures market because I'm long life. I've got, you know, an entire position on that's always long. So I can't go into that futures market thinking that I've got to be long because I'm long everything else. So it's the time to start using some of these instruments for their intended purpose. Another good product out there, and it's only a short-term product, I don't endorse this for the long-term, are these double and triple leveraged downside ETFs. SPXS is a good one, only because you get some huge fast action if indeed we see these moves like we saw in March. And remember, for those that are new traders out there, and we know this that are on this you know podcast right now, the market has got a whole different psychology when it goes down than when it goes up. Yeah. When it goes down, there's that fear, there's that panic. You see the explosion in the VIX and all that protection and everything that I've been talking about, these one by two positions that you would put in the puts or whatever the case is, will explode in value. Is really what happens much quicker usually than when markets go higher, where you start to see, you know, the euphoria and you know the greed that kind of starts to come in the FOMO, which we're starting to see a little bit of these days, especially with Azac.
Speaking of hedging, I've been looking at the dollar and it's had a pretty rough run as the market has bounced back, but on a longer term basis, say over the last year, it's basically where it was a year ago. Other central banks are bailing as fast as the Fed is, I presume. Would you imagine the dollar would continue to go down as the economy and markets kind of bounce back?
I think the dollar is probably just getting back to where it should be. You know, we saw a run into the dollar because, you know, it is a perceived, you know, safe haven. It is for if you're sitting in Russia, if you're sitting in China, if you're sitting anywhere in the world, if you're sitting in Germany or Italy, you know, you're looking at the U.S. dollar as a place to put your capital, to put your assets and just park it there, which is exactly what we saw over the course of those last, you know, 6 to 8 weeks or at least the weeks prior to the pandemic. And it really started to show that strength and it play into the market. Remember, there's this relationship where you see the dollar go higher and everything that's dollar denominated go lower. It's one of the reasons why, as we saw the dollar go up, the whole question of disinflationary pressure started to come about again. But now that we're seeing the dollar go back down, and especially in light of what we're seeing around the world, and you just talked about the rest of the central banks, I think it's really a question of what's going to happen with inflation. It's a question that we haven't asked for a long time. And now all of a sudden with the, you know, printing money haphazardly, I guess, the real question is, you know, are we seeing serious currency debasement? And are we going to end up losing purchase power parity down the road, you know, if indeed we don't hedge out some kind of vehicle?
Right. So now that was a huge concern coming out of the financial crisis. And as you mentioned earlier, the Fed's doing a lot more and the government fiscal policy response has been larger as well, at least in the initial phase. Are you concerned about the dollar and the implications? And as I mentioned, you're also chairman of the Global Smart Commodity Group. I would think that would be good for most commodities if that's the case.
Well, I remember, commodities are more a function of supply and demand. So the dollar going down, yes. Does it affect the commodities markets? Of course, because you see everything that dollar denominated go higher. But what we did back in 2010 and all the work that was done by the Federal Reserve and TARP and everything else that came out, I was convinced at the time that we were going to see inflation. In fact, I got on television at the time with Art Cashin and we talked about it. And then we actually realized that we miscalculated the velocity of inflation. Something was going on, I guess, that was working its way through the economy. And it turns out to be that it was probably technology. It was Moore's Law. Things were getting faster and cheaper every 3 years. Things were becoming more and more efficient. But it was something that I guess I didn't catch on to. But being a product of the 70s, I mean, I saw what inflation did to the economy. I realize, how bad it can get. But, right now, I think that it's good to keep an eye out for it. And I think that the warning signals will be if we start to see the long end of the yield curve start to spike up. If I start to see the 30-year over, say, 3%, or, the 10-year, which now is starting to approach 1%, over, say, 1.5, then, it's going to get on my radar screen again. And, and the other thing, and just I'll leave it with this. There are other assets out there that you would think would start to come off if the market would go up, gold being one of them. But we're not seeing that. Gold is still maintaining levels. That tells you that the world has still got some fear.
All right, our guest has been Jack Baroogian. He's the chief economist and co-founder of UCX and chairman of Global Smart Commodity Group. Jack, thanks very much for being here today.
Oh, my pleasure, guys.
Thank you, Jack.